This keynote is called The Art of Rainmaking. The three most important words for an entrepreneur are revenue, revenue, and revenue. In this keynote session, you'll learn the 10 proven sales strategies and techniques for making the cash register ring. Let it rain. It is given by Bill Jost, Director, Graz Technology Ventures.
I told you earlier that my DNA was sales guy, and we're going to talk a little bit about rainmaking. So I'd like to go through a number of topics as we talk about rainmaking, and I'm going to do it again in the top 10 format that you've sort of become accustomed to. And the first one of these is let 100 flowers blossom and sow many seeds and see what grows. The key point here is so many of you think you know what your market is, that the trick is to not be blind to those interesting opportunities that may in fact come from other places. Obviously, as you know, I ripped this off of Chairman Mao. But the point on this is, find out where things are growing and don't be blind to the fact that they may not be exactly where you think. And I can cite three examples that will be helpful on that. The inventor of Novocaine thought it was going to be a wonderful thing for traditional surgeons. And for reasons that were as much political as medical, the doctor community, the MD community, rejected it out of hand. But he was smart enough to realize that there were a number of people in the dentist community that in fact had adopted this, and rather than endlessly chasing MDs that had made their mind up that this wasn't appropriate for them, he went after a market that he never intended on going after. The second is Univac. Univac, as you know, now resides in one place, a history museum of computers, because their focus was on the scientific community, and they were blind to any business opportunities. IBM, on the other hand, was open to business opportunities, and that's why Univac is no longer around. The third example, one that's near and dear to Guy's heart, is Apple. When Macintosh first came out, the theory was, if we only had a spreadsheet, a database, and a word processor, we will do wonderful things. And lo and behold, it was an unintended area called desktop publishing that really put Macintosh on the map. In all of these cases, opportunities existed that wasn't the primary focus for the entrepreneur. A classic example of that I call don't be blind to guerrilla thinking. An interesting study was done where they showed a videotape to a number of college students. And on the videotape, there were three people catching a ball. And the instructions were, keep track of how many balls each person catches. The guy in the red shirt, the blue shirt, and the yellow shirt. And afterwards, we're going to have you do that. And this experiment ran about 4 minutes. Midway through, a guy comes out in a gorilla costume, clearly visible, makes a gorilla call, beats his chest. He's on screen for 9 seconds and leaves. 50% of the audience viewing the videotape did not see the gorilla. 50% did not see the gorilla. They were too focused on the task at hand, which was watching these guys play catch, and the gorilla is clearly visible. I tried to get the videotape to show you, and I just wasn't able to do it. Don't be blind to gorilla opportunities. Additionally, and the key here is really, get version one out and then pay very close attention. Pay incredible attention to who's doing something with version one and what are they doing. You may find that your initial market thoughts are not your true market. And don't be blind to that. People like Univac, instead of changing, spent a huge amount of money in those days trying to succeed in the scientific market. They were damn determined if they didn't know who their best customer was and went broke, or but essentially spent huge amounts of resources and capital chasing the market that wasn't theirs. Second point, find your fulcrums. It's all about leverage. In this day and age, it's virtually impossible to succeed by yourself. You have to find people that you can use as lever points. And about that, there's a couple of things to do. First is get taken in. Who already, let's assume you're selling, let's say, enterprise software. Who does your customer already have a trusted relationship with? Who is an intermediary on that a trusted relationship that is already delivering an acceptable product and has the relationship that you long for. You may very well find that in that case you're going to do something with one of the major consulting firms. So think about those types of opportunities. Who in a perfect world should be your new best friend? Now, interestingly enough, you should also figure out who should be your worst enemy. Because stranger things have happened than people pairing with somebody that once was a death competitor and now turned in to be one of the new best friends. So the first point is, get taken in by a trusted intermediary. The second is, get referred in. And by getting referred in, who can bring you to that party? If a human being can't, who can? Now, a whole lot of things have been said today about board of directors. Almost nothing's been said about board of advisors. But board of advisors early on is more important than a board of directors, because they are people, generally your beta customers, they're somebody that's extraordinarily knowledgeable in the field or domain that you are, that is going to be and act as a steering committee for you on what's right. The key thing on board of advisors is don't be shy. Figure out who your dream board of advisors is and try and get them. They're in a different kettle of fish legally than board members. Their compensation, if anything, is significantly less. And they're the ones that bring the credibility to your other new prospects and customers. So consider that. The third is, who is your American Dental Association? You know, if I turn the crest box over and I have the arrow, it says that this is endorsed, doesn't say those words, but by presence of their logo, by the American Dental Association. Who is your equivalent of that? Now, I know most of you are not doing retail products, but in a perfect world, who is your endorser? Who can legitimize what you are doing as a leverage point to help accelerate that area? Additionally, who besides you has a vested interest in your success? Now, this is an interesting opportunity. One of our clients is dealing with some technology from Cisco and some technology from IBM that they show off in a particularly unique manner, one that is driving the acceptance of those products when the large behemoths could not. They clearly have a vested interest in this company's success. So find a way to leverage those alliances and those partnerships, because you're going to find, you know, when you can answer this question, who besides you, you're going to have some very interesting answers. And the last one here is, always be on the lookout for out-of-box fulcrums, other than the normal channels. The thing that is interesting is we will ask that question of people that come in and sit in our boardroom. Who are you going to leverage to assist you on your success? And I would say probably less than two-thirds have a great answer for that. I would say fully one-third has never thought about it based on how they stammer and stumble through their answers. But to try and do it alone in this day and age is almost impossible to do. You clearly need to understand who that third party is and how that's involved. The next point, go after agnostics, not atheists. I don't want to try and convert somebody that doesn't believe in God. I want someone that's open to it. And you're going to see how this ties as we go into the next point. But you're after the target that say, you know, there may be a God. I'm not closed-minded on it. Because what you're going to find is that you want an agnostic who already knows he has this problem and is open to that solution. As you take a look at the different types of sales, and there's four or five, the hardest sale of all is the displacement sale. You've already made a decision. That is not a satisfactory solution. You need to do something different. It's the hardest sale there is, because somebody in that company fell in love with the current solution, and they're going to fight you on that. The additive sale is at least a magnitude easier than the displacement sale. It's at least a magnitude easier. But yet, I see people all the time, when they show us their pipeline, they're going after people that are already using the competitive product, and they now are in a situation where they're trying to do an expensive, time-consuming, long sell cycle displacement sale. In fact, the very company that I was mentioning that has a relationship with Cisco and IBM, they have the path of least resistance approach. If you are already doing something with digital media, and you've already made a commitment to somebody to assist you to deal with that digital media, we will integrate and make that solution better. You don't need to throw out what you already have. Now, as it come to find out, most people, once they've worked with that product, come to the realization themselves that they have a more comprehensive solution and should abandon the other product. But imagine the difficulty of the sell cycle if you went in and said, I'm good, they're bad, switch to me. Almost impossible to do. What they said is, what have you made your choices with already? Yes, we work with them. We enhance their performance and their abilities. And now let's figure out how to go in and do that. So think about additive sales rather than displacement sales. Displacement sales, tremendously frustrating, but yet when I ask people for their pipelines, I see more of that than the additive sales. Don't let the prospects give you the shits. That's an acronym. It says, show high interest, then stall. VCs have been known to do that. The point is, get rid of the someday maybes when you're working on your pipeline, because the people that are someday going to give you business are going to drag it out forever. Now, that isn't saying you should. It's like your portfolio. You need some bonds, you need some mutual funds, you need some stocks. You need some of these guys, but don't make it a steady state. Now, I'm sure a number of you know who Willie Sutton is. Willie Sutton was a bank robber born in 1907, robbed banks for a living, and when he was finally captured, they said to him, Willie, why do you rob banks? And with surprise in his voice, he said, because that's where the money is. The answer is, who can afford your solutions? Go where that business is, because the revenue is king. It used to be location, location, location. In real estate, now it's revenue, revenue, revenue. And as Bill mentioned in his bootstrapping, momentum and traction is one of the most important things you can show a professional investor. A number of years ago, I developed a number of marketing and sales laws, of which I'll only tell you two. And the first one I call the Bill Jost Mousetrap Law. And it basically says, it's my first law of marketing, and it says, it's not enough to build a better mousetrap. You have to find people with a passion to murder mice. A mousetrap alone is not adequate. You have to find a way to take that to market. The second law that I learned when I was with IBM, and I don't have it on the chart, was I was selling iron for IBM. When you solve the customer's number one problem, number two gets a promotion. So figure out what those are, and when we get to the questioning phase, in just a moment, you can see how some of that ties. Four, influence the influencers. Now, as you go into these more complicated sales, you're going to have a wide variety of people who can influence the decision. You can have people that are the technical evaluator. You can have people that are the champions, and God bless the champions. They're the people that want you to win within that company. Find a champion and part of your problems are over, because they can explain what's really going on. We have people that are going to be doing cost evaluation. We have people that are going to be doing the end users. The point is, how do you sort of figure out who matters within that organization? So a couple of points that come up on here. The first is, stop, look, and listen. And amazing things happen when you ask the right questions. In fact, it's so important, it's going to be one of my points that we're going to be talking about in just a few minutes. But if you ask the right questions on how decisions get made, some amazing things can happen. Guy has a theory that says, instead of managing up, you should suck down. And what he means by that is, lower-tiered people in the organization, other than CEOs, CTOs, have an amazing amount of information if you only know how to tap into them. So the lowly, pick one, the lowly receptionist, she knows who's been in and out of the door. Now, you may not find that out from her, but you sure may find it out when you look at the sign-in sheet. In other words, you can find out these influencers in a number of very, very interesting ways. So not only should you play down, but you can play up. The one thing I learned very well at IBM is if I call on the president or chairman and they refer me down, believe me, it's much easier for me to get that meeting with that mid-tier manager when I say, I'm talking to you because Mr. Big suggested I do so. So play both ends of the spectrum as you do your stop, look, and listen on who can be the possible influencer on that. Now, the larger, the longer the sell cycle, the higher the ticket, the more people can influence that decision. Learn the difference between screeners, decision makers, roadblockers, because it may be a very complex road. You're going to find a lot of people that have the ability to say no. You're going to have difficulty finding that very singular person that can say yes without a bunch of other people nodding their heads. So influence the influencers. Point five. Make the first steps easy. Win a small victory before you go after the war. If you take a look at a couple organizations that have done that particularly well, you know, in sales is, you know, the kind of puppy dog clothes. Take it home over the weekend, see if you like the dog. You know, who brings the puppy back? But if you take a look at people that have really done this well, and let's think of an example. Salesforce.com has done this well. With no or little money down, you can try their product in some limited fashion. And once you've tried it and are sort of hooked on it, don't underestimate the power of switching costs once you get adopting, you know, once you start adopting something. So make it easy on that. Additionally, you may want to pick a piece of a company or a trial that allows them to do it without it being enterprise-wide or corporate-wide. You may want to, in fact, win an office or a plant. You may want to win a particular geography. You may want them to try your solution, particularly on a given project. Or you may have some limited function version that can only have a file of such a large size, or maybe it's only good for 45 days. But the acid test here when you're dealing with your people is determine what, in fact, if the roles were reversed, would make it easy for you to do business with yourself. You know, one of Guy's laws is don't do something, you know, don't expect someone to do something that you yourself wouldn't do. But yet, sometimes when I talk to customers about getting a product in, they want that hook in so far, they're afraid to let the customer test drive it, trial it, or sample the product. They're just afraid to give away a taste of that, that they've really cheated themselves out of some tremendous business. So consider some of those issues as you take a look at making the first steps easy. Additionally, we've talked a lot, or not a lot, but it's been alluded to about marketing methods. And I'd like to tell you about a study that was done that's a pretty interesting one. And that is for entrepreneurial companies, what are the five most important ways you can get leads? And the study was done, and they came up with these five, and they're not always the ones you think. You will notice in advance that what is missing is high-end collateral, marketing pieces. Even the internet itself was missing when the study was done, and that study's not that old. The most effective area is small-scale seminars. Create a gathering at your podium. Whether you're doing something at a local restaurant, whether you're doing something at Quadras out on Sand Hill Road, do something where you can get a small gathering of people at your podium with potentially a testimonial from one of your reference accounts, and allow that dialogue to happen. That was number one. Number two, find somebody else's podium. I have predominant responsibility for putting on the garage conferences. And I would say from the time we announce a conference until we do the conference, I get probably 20 emails, God bless them all, that says, I understand you're doing a conference. My client should be a speaker from a PR firm. Or I should be a speaker because I can bring a unique need on such and such. So from the time that we announce a conference and put it on our website, without even the agenda, just the teaser of the conference, like one we're going to be doing in this very venue in October, I started having people come to me saying, shouldn't I be considered as a panelist? Shouldn't I be considered? And from time to time, we in fact do that. But it's the people that are hungry that can find somebody else's podium. Number three, get published. And you can do this in a couple of ways. If you can't find a publication, create one. This is the internal white paper that you write about your firm. It can end up on your website. It can end up in the hands of your partners and alliances. Create a publication if you don't have one. Now, most of you have an amazing number of publications available to you if you just think out of the box on how to do that. Number four, proactive networking. You know, it's really interesting. How many of you read the book? Well, I won't ask. You should all read the book called The Tipping Point. And The Tipping Point does a couple of very interesting things. It talks about what does it take for something to catch fire. And another study that came out since The Tipping Point was interesting. They gave 100 people a name of somebody in Europe and said, we want you to contact this person through email. And then after the fact, they went back and determined how that was done. Interestingly enough, the quickest way to get to that person in Europe wasn't through friends, meaning a close circle. It was through acquaintances, meaning a broader circle. Because your friends have many of the same contacts that you do. Networking acquaintances are every bit as important as friends. In fact, in this example, it was more important than friends. But networking is the exact opposite of cold calling. It is a give and take. You have to give to the network to get. What that usually means is you're going to spend a portion of your professional life talking about products and services being sold by people in your network, assuming they're not competitive to you. Giving a lead, getting a lead. Proactive networking, which is helping and giving to your network with an expectation of getting back. It was the fourth most effective tool for sales generation. And the fifth was participate in industry events. And here, the study broke it into two specific areas. Your own industry, which interestingly enough, may provide you the microphone that you're looking for on number two, and your customers' industries. So as you do that, think about exploring the right lead generation. Point seven, you got two ears and one mouth. And that ratio should probably be about 5 to 1. Talk more, listen less. A couple of interesting things happen. First of all, a lot of people mistake hearing for listening. They're dramatically different. Most of us, initially, were extremely bad listeners. We had to be trained to become active or intelligent listeners. And the interesting point here is, listen with the pen. Think of me flattering somebody that what they're says is so important in a meeting that I say, do you mind if I jot that down? Pull my pen out, jot it. Because it gives me some ammunition that I can go back and use later. Because I have a school of thought that says, if you have a healthy curiosity and you listen to not only what's said but what is not being said, your customer, for the most part, is going to tell you what it takes to close the deal if you simply ask the questions. Now, earlier today, I alluded to my favorite two VC questions. What are the three most important things you would like to learn about my business plan? And what attracted you to my business plan? But when you go into a sales situation, there's a number of questions that if you simply ask, it's going to help provide the impetus for what you want. Example. All of our customers have a little different decision-making process. What is yours? It's a healthy curiosity question. It's non-offensive. But I want insight into how that decision is going to get made. Naturally, I'm going to ask follow-on questions. Who besides you is involved in this decision? What kind of budget have you set aside for this solution? But I'm curious, and I have a healthy curiosity. How is the decision made at your company? A variation on the one that we used with the VCs this morning. As you look at solving this problem, what are the top three criteria that you'll be taking into account? Again, you know my love for stack-ranked questions. It helps to give insight into values of somebody. In a perfect world, if you could change your approach to solving this problem, what would that be? Non-threatening, but I'm asking nice, open-ended questions because they themselves are going to tell me what it takes to sell to them if I only do it. What are the strengths of your current solution? What are its weaknesses? How would you like to change it? Again, healthy curiosity asked innocently in the sense of naively, but asked in a sincere manner, they're going to do that. Where does solving this problem fall in your priority list? I know you got a lot of things to do here. You want to find out how critical that pain is so you know how to rank your painkiller. And finally, the one that just will open doors for you, what else have I overlooked in our discussion today? It's a wonderful question because sometimes the damnedest things will come out of the mouth of the prospect. So 2 ears, 1 mouth, and that ratio exists for a reason. Point number 8, there are huge benefits to benefits. And in here, I need to tell you a story. I have two friends that work together at the San Diego Zoo. And one of their jobs was working with Molly the elephant. Now, when I was talking to them about their job, they would start talking about Molly with this loving way. They've spent a huge amount of time caring for Molly. And one of them would say, you know, this is a 3-year-old elephant that weighs 7,000 pounds. And they would look at each other and kind of mentally high-five each other. And, you know, they could even smell Molly. They were, you know, as they're telling me the story, they would say something like that. Now, from that 3-year-old 7,000 pounds meant something to them. But to me, it didn't mean a damn thing. I don't know if Molly is the rare pygmy elephant that after 3 years only weighs 7,000 pounds. Or whether Molly is the fastest growing jumbo elephant on earth that after 3 years already weighs 7,000 pounds. But you know what? It meant something to them. I can't tell you the number of VC presentations that Bill and I and Guy are in where they make a statement like a 3-year-old 7,000 pound elephant. It's meaningful to their side of the table, but it doesn't mean a doggone thing to us. If you're going to make a statement from which you want me to draw a conclusion, give me a framework to understand that conclusion. Now, when I was trained by IBM, training you couldn't afford to buy in this day and age, I was trained by IBM for 1 year before I was allowed to touch a customer of my own. They gave me a very important thing, and that is an invisible man that sits on my shoulder to this day. Now, I don't talk to this invisible man because I'd get carted away. But this invisible man has one job, and that is to hear everything that is coming out of my mouth. And when I make a statement like Molly, it leans over and says in my ear, "So what?" And there's an art to understanding, "So what?" What is the benefit on the feature that you're talking about? So many of us are involved in features that the so what benefits get lost. And the technique that many people have found works really well is called FBRs. I'm going to discuss a feature. I'm going to discuss a so what benefit. And wherever possible, I'm going to dollarize a benefit. And then R is reaction. Was this on track? Did it matter to that person? Think about how you would make a change to that, and if you're off target, why are you off target? So whatism, if there's such a word, is one of the critical things, and you'd be amazed at how seldom we hear it when people are making the biggest sales call, one of the biggest sales calls of their, what they're doing, and that is to try and get money from a venture capital firm. Don't object to objections. They're the stepping stones to yes. Because basically what an objection is a way they're saying, tell me more. Now, all of you have things you hope you're never asked. And when I'm working with clients, I call those the squirmers. In an exercise, they say, tell me the 10 things you hope you are never, ever asked in a sales call or a VC call or whatever, and we're going to put them on a whiteboard. Because until I can come up with answers for those, I'll be scared of objections forever. But once you've identified your squirmers, all the rest come easy. So think about the things you really don't want to be asked about, because you will be. It's inverse. The worse you fear it, the greater the chance of you being asked. So figure out a way to handle that. Now, the challenge is most people answer the wrong objection. The real objection is buried down multiple layers. And let me give you a one-layer example. The prospect says, I can't afford your solution. Your brain says, price is the object, and you go into a pricing response. Maybe the reason they couldn't afford it didn't mean the dollar afford it. Maybe they meant we can't take the manpower to implement your solution. Maybe that's what they meant by the example in the word afford. And the beautiful thing is, simply ask. I heard you tell me you can't afford my solution. I could interpret that several ways. Which way did you mean it? Imagine that same example where the prospect says, I can't afford it, and you think it's a pricing objection, and you say, oh, it's only $50,000 up front, and yada, 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 and you hadn't gotten to price before. You've now introduced a real objection when, in fact, there wasn't one. Studies have shown, videotape role plays and sales call examples have shown, that more people spend time answering the wrong objection than the right one because they refuse to peel the onion. And the key is to verify and clarify prior to answering. They're two sides to the same coin. Another technique is to make objections into objectives. Let's say that your customer says, let's say you're shipping something, and your customer says, I don't think you can ship that on time. You can turn that around and say, what I hear you telling me is that on-time shipment is an objective that you're going to take into account when you make your decision. Yes. Fine. Let me tell you how we can meet that objective. So take objections and make them into objectives. The other thing is, after your first customer, you have a wonderful response device. If somebody says, why is your product better? Imagine I have two choices. I can put the words out of my mouth, a silver-tongued sales guy that no one trusts, or I can put the words out of my customer's mouth that already is using me. Let's assume the customer says, gee, it sounds like your solution is pretty complicated. Now, I could get into this third-grade sandbox stuff, is not, is so, no, it's not, let me tell you why. But here I have a wonderful thing as soon as I have a customer. I understand how you feel. Joe Blow at XYZ felt the same thing, but what he found was that 3 man-weeks of implementing our enterprise software solution had a 9-month payback. So you can empathize with your customer on this, and as soon as you have a reference account, parlay that into other business. Last is sort of the Columbo, and I don't know if you remember the Columbo. Trench raincoat, cigar, he's walking out and he turns and says, I just got one more question for you. And this is kind of like you didn't win the battle. And you say, you know, I'd just like to ask you one thing. Why did you go with the competition? I'd just like to know. And you say it with your most defeated attitude. And very frequently they will tell you why, opening the door for you to come back and go, I really should have addressed that clearer. Let me explain what my thinking is on that. But if you can act innocent, if you can ask, if you can act curious, and if you can ask the right questions, Amazing things can happen in the rainmaking process. And the last point before I turn it over to Bill Riker to summarize the conference is selling is not a process. You don't go on a sales call. That is a step in something much larger. It is a process, not an event. And when you understand that process and it gets integrated into your and your team's thinking, you will find that everyone is doing all sales all the time. For the people that think that they're isolating selling to the sales guy, they don't get it. Because it is a process that involves and uses everyone within your organization. Thank you very much.
To learn more about this topic and other subjects that will help you build a great company, be sure to read Guy Kawasaki's latest book, The Art of the Start. It will be available in the first week of September from online bookstores as well as brick-and-mortar bookstores. Thank you very much.